Good morning, Sunday morning.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, Wednesday morning. Patrick Madrid here. Thank you for listening. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We have people waiting, chomping at the bit. Let's go get over to George now in Torrance, California. Good morning, George. You're first up. Welcome.
Last night I listened to your replay, and a gentleman caller was lamenting that the footnotes of his Bible were sort of like a buzzkill, if you will, that they took away from what he thought would have been more of an orthodoxy type of explanation. And it brought me to the footnotes of the Bible I have. And as I mentioned to your screener, what I had read here is like a 180-degree more positive turn on the same prayer, the Magnificat. And I was wondering if I had your permission to read what the footnotes say.
Sure, go ahead. Which Bible edition is this from, by the way?
Patrick, this is the New Catholic Bible.
New Catholic Bible, okay.
And it says...
please proceed,
sir. Luke... Thank you. It's Luke 1, 46 to 55. Mary's splendid canticle, the Magnificat, proclaims a new course for history, the end of injustice and the birth of a new world, that of the kingdom in which everything is different from our habitual experience. Every person gives thanks to God. The joy of poor bursts forth. Hope is born for the salvation of the despised of this world. And the last paragraph says, the Magnificat, which is similar to Hannah's canticle in 1 Samuel 2, verse 110, and has become the Christian song of thanksgiving, leads itself to be the prayer of those who have suffered but have never lost hope in God. The entire prayer of the Old Testament converges upon this one, but with a holy, renewed power. It is easy to see why the church never tires of reciting it as one of the gems of the church's daily office of evening prayer in Vespers. So that is very different from what that gentleman was experiencing. Thank you for the opportunity to read it.
Yes, that's correct. So for those who are listening now and maybe didn't hear that conversation from yesterday's program, it actually had two parts, and I don't know if you heard the second part of it. The second part, well, the first part involved the gentleman calling up, and he was one of at least two callers, I forget if there was a third one, who expressed surprise and dismay that some of the notes in the New American Bible were tendentious in that they promoted what I referred to yesterday as a hermeneutic of suspicion. And Jesus didn't really
say that. Yes, I remember that
Matthew
word.
Didn't really write. Okay, yeah. So Jesus didn't really say that. It's a good one, though. Also, that this miracle probably didn't happen this way, or this wasn't really said. This was added later by a later redactor. And the one that it always sort of sticks out in my mind is in the introduction to the Gospel according to St. Matthew. It's very blatant. It says, well, St. Matthew the Apostle did not write this Gospel. And that, of course, has been the position of the Catholic Church from the time of the writing of the Gospels, that St. Matthew did write this Gospel. And so it simply just dismisses that and says, we don't really know who wrote it, but we're just going to go along with convention and say that Matthew wrote it. I'm obviously paraphrasing here, but if you open the New American Bible and read the introduction, you'll see what I'm referring to. And that for the sake of convention, we will just say that this Gospel was written by Matthew, but it wasn't written by Matthew. Things like that. And so the gentleman's point was, as you heard, and this again for the benefit of people who may not have heard yesterday's program, he said, this is confusing, and I thought the Catholic Church said, you know, these things were true, and the notes are calling them into question, saying they're not true, etc. And at least one other caller shared the same perspective, possibly a third one. But I also, the second half of the conversation, was a gentleman who called who was opposed to, he disagreed with my response to this. He disagreed with my criticism of these notes. And his position was that this is a good thing. He even said, and I hope I'm capturing accurately what he said, something along the lines of confusion is the beginning of learning. And we didn't get much of a chance to delve into that, so maybe he meant something other than the way it sounded. But my point, or my contention, is that confusion is not the beginning of learning. Our God is not a God of confusion, so he's going to lead us into all truth, as Jesus said in John's Gospel. So that was sort of the essence of the whole thing. And I was surprised that it resonated as much as it did with the people who listened, mainly because, I mean, yes. Catholics, let's face it, are not known for being avid Bible readers. So in a way, I was pleased to see that people reacted to this, because they are reading the Bible and they are seeing these things. And that's a good sign in any case.
Oh, amen to that. Amen to that. And, you know, you are the lightning rod for helping us go through this. And I thank God for blessing you with the ministry you have. And may I refer upon you and your family and your staff a very happy reception day.
Thank you so much. That's kind of you, and I appreciate your sentiment. I reciprocate it warmly. God bless you, especially during this blessed Advent season. Thank you, George. We'll go now to Yoli in Anaheim, California, the home of Disneyland. Oh. Welcome, Yoli.
Oh,
can you see the Matterhorn from where you're standing right now?
No, but I can hear the fireworks daily.
Yeah, they do that.
Happy Feast Day Immaculate Conception. I love your wisdom, Patrick.
Thank you.
While having three different conversations, one with a Protestant, the other Jehovah's Witness, and one with a Christian, it surprised me, their answer. They all told me that God doesn't punish, and I would love to hear your response.
Well, okay, so God doesn't punish. Let's, first of all, take a look at what Jesus himself said. If we can, maybe you could ask the person this question, do you believe in Jesus? If the person says yes, do you believe that Jesus is God? I mean, after all, he claimed to be God. The people took up stones to stone him to death because of the way he was describing himself. The Father and I are one. Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father, etc. And he says, for which of my good deeds do you seek to stone me? And they said, it's not for any of your good deeds, but because you who are a man are making yourself out to be God. And stoning to death was the capital punishment reserved for a few offenses. One of them was blasphemy. So the people clearly understood that Jesus was claiming to be God. So in your conversation, you could say to this person, do you believe in Jesus? Let's say the answer is yes. Do you believe that he's God? I mean, he claimed to be. Okay, yes, he's God. So how do you square your belief that God does not punish with the multiple times that Jesus, who is the fullness of revelation of the triune God, he said repeatedly that those who do not believe and who do not repent will be punished? And he didn't say it just once or twice or three times. He said it dozens of times. He warns about it dozens of times. You might give, for example, the statements that Jesus makes in Matthew chapter 25, when he talks about the sheep and the goats, this, you know, this explanation of it, when the final judgment takes place. And he says about the goats that they will be sent off into the eternal fire that has been prepared for the devil and his angels. So they go off to punishment. Now, I don't think it's necessary to pile on with massive amounts of Bible verses. A few will be sufficient. So maybe you can then open up the conversation and say, how do you square this with your view that God doesn't punish anyone when Jesus says he does? And then sit back. If you have some popcorn handy, have a little popcorn, and then see how that person tries to resolve this. Because the obvious correct answer is God indeed does punish people. Nowadays, Yoli, and I think this may be more of a cultural phenomenon than anything else. It's certainly not a theological insight, but more of a cultural phenomenon born of a society in which we chafe at any kind of restriction, any kind of authority telling us we must do this or that, unless, of course, you're all about, you know, government control over your lives when it comes to COVID. But outside of that, many people nowadays, just the very thought that they might be punished for doing something, it's irksome to them, because I should be able to do it my way no matter what. Nobody can tell me what I can do. My body, my choice, that kind of thing. So I don't recall seeing this notion when I was growing up. I don't really remember seeing people say, well, I believe in a God who's merciful and he would never punish anyone. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention. But it seems like now our culture is so steeped in this idea that I can do whatever I want and you can't tell me what I can and can't do, that it has now permeated into people's view of God, and they just assume that because they demand to have absolute freedom to do whatever they want, that God, of course, will feel the same way, and that's not reality. So if I were having this conversation, that might be the tack I would take, Yoli.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. God bless you.
God bless you, too. Cyrus, this is the best job on earth, may I say to you.
That's a fact.
It is a fact. Hey, those guys that got in trouble, well, one guy got in big trouble, Louis C.K., comedian. I won't say why he got in trouble specifically, except that he was doing some immoral things. You probably remember the whole hashtag Me Too movement and people getting, well, canceled is one good word for it, their careers destroyed. In some cases, I think quite rightly. Some people got away with terrible things for a long time, and it eventually caught up to them. Depredations against women. I'm thinking about people like Bill Cosby, for example.
Okay.
Louis C.K., funny guy. I mean, I've enjoyed his humor here and there. I mean, I don't think I've ever actually sat through one of his shows or anything, but I've seen some things on YouTube. One of his funniest bits that I ever saw was, he's being interviewed on one of the late night programs, and he's talking about how people complain so much. You know, like one guy, he was on a plane, and this is shortly after Wi-Fi became available on planes, maybe 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was. And this guy is complaining because he can't get on the internet while they're on a flight. And he says he's complaining about something he didn't even know, existed 10 minutes earlier. And now he's complaining because it's not available, Wi-Fi on a plane. And he says, think about that. I mean, you're sitting in a chair in the sky. I love that line. You're sitting in a chair in the sky. You're flying across the country at 35,000 feet. You can go from New York to Los Angeles in 5 hours. And he's complaining because he doesn't have Wi-Fi. So that was the essence of the bit. It was funny, and I appreciate it for what it was. But when the stories started coming out about some of the things that he did in his private time, with women, etc., he got shut down hard. And so I think he lost all of his gigs, and his work went down to zero. And they tried to do that with Dave Chappelle most recently because of his comments in his comedy show that I had no intention of watching, but because so many people were buzzing about it. You remember this, Cyrus, maybe 2-3 months ago, something like that?
Yeah, maybe not even that long.
Maybe not even that long. And I can appreciate Dave Chappelle's humor. I don't enjoy sitting through a barrage of four-letter words and things like that. So I don't generally watch shows like that. But this was important enough, and it was a cultural phenomenon. And the bigger picture, of course, was that all the trans people were up in arms because he was being critical of them. And so I watched the show. You and I talked about it on this program. And I thought he said some things that were true and even appropriate under the circumstances. And although they haven't been successful, they went into overdrive at Netflix and in other platforms as to trying to get him deplatformed, trying to get his show canceled, trying to get him basically shut down. And these two guys, Louis C.K. and Dave Chappelle, are just two examples of many other people who have suffered. And as I say, in some cases, rightfully suffered. I don't defend people doing bad things, and I certainly believe in justice. So if they're out there doing bad things, they should be, you know, this should be dealt with. Who's the guy, the movie guy? What's his name? The guy that's in jail now. I can't remember his name. It'll come to me. The
guy that's in jail.
So people, Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah. Oh, that guy's...
He was wall-to-wall for a while.
He's diabolical.
Well, you know, the stories that were brought forth in his in the accusations and things, if it's true, and of course, only God knows and he knows if it's true, and I guess the people involved, But assuming that it's true, yeah, he was depraved in so many of the things that he did. But these are just examples of the phenomenon. So the reason I'm bringing this up is that some of these people are actually being rehabilitated. And one theory is that the so-called cancel culture, as many on the right call it, that may be dwindling. So here's the take on this. This is from TMZ, talking about Louis C.K. and Dave Chappelle. They both got Grammy nominations for the upcoming Grammys. Despite their individual battles with the cancel culture, a signal maybe canceling people is on the wane, is what they're saying. The Academy announced its picks a week or two ago. Louis C.K. received a nomination for Best Comedy Album and Chappelle for Best Spoken Word Album. Twitter was quick to react, mostly full of people who have had it up to here with the cancel culture. One user wrote, Louis C.K. just got nominated for a Grammy in case people wanted to keep clutching their pearls about the long-term effects of cancel culture. And that's, of course, being critical of those who are critical of the cancel culture. This whole clutching your pearls meme, this term, whatever, I'm not going to comment on that. Another said, only one Grammy nomination each for Dave Chappelle, Kevin Hart, and Louis C.K. Cancel culture strikes again. So they're being cynical. They're being sarcastic. Back in 2017, Louis C.K. admitted to doing these things that I won't describe to you. He got in trouble. I'm just condensing. So they're using the Grammy nominations as a barometer to measure whether or not this cancel culture against them will be permanent. And based on that, it looks like, at least for them, it's not going to stick, that they will emerge better and stronger. How about Kramer? I know we have to take a break in a minute, but Kramer on Seinfeld.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, did you ever watch that video?
I did. Yep, yeah, he was doing stand up. Go ahead and say what you remember.
Oh no. I want to hear your thoughts.
Michael Richards. He's a brilliant actor. Brilliant actor. I don't know anything about his personal life. I remember watching Michael Richards on a show called Fridays. It was sort of a spin. It wasn't a spin-off, but it was sort of like a wannabe contender with Saturday Night Live back in the, what was it? I think it was the 80s, early 80s maybe. And he was this bizarre, very funny actor who would do, he basically was doing Kramer. That he was doing that role, but not by that name. And it was sketch comedy, like in Living Color back in the olden days. And I remember watching this guy, had no idea who he was. And then I lost track of him for many years until Seinfeld came out. But I thought he was absolutely brilliant and extremely funny. So when he showed up as Kramer on Seinfeld, that was a win. It's one of the things I liked about Seinfeld is that he surrounded himself with very strong characters. So long story short, and you remember this, Cyrus, Michael Richards was doing some stand-up, and he was in character, as he says, as he tells the story, and he was sort of dealing with two hecklers who were heckling him. And it got racial, I think, in both directions. I'd have to go back and review the video. And that was it. He got zapped, and he was done. And he's been done ever since then. That must be at least 10, 12 years ago that this happened. And I think all of his work dried up. I'm guessing he probably made a lot of money on Seinfeld, so he can probably pay the rent every month. He did have one episode on Seinfeld's riding in cars with comedians getting coffee. And that was really sad. Did you ever see that episode, Cyrus?
I didn't see Michael that Richards one. Appeared? No. Curb Your Enthusiasm did like a Seinfeld reunion season, and so I saw him on that. But he wasn't even used very much. He was used less than I would have liked because I liked that character, Kramer, so much.
He's a great character.
Yeah.
Well, if you ever get a chance to see it, and I know we have to take a break, I'll just leave this here. If you want to see the ravages of the cancel culture, if we're allowed to call it that anymore, with Michael Richards because of his dust-up with some hecklers at a comedy event that he was doing. And again, it was racially charged, so that, I think, is probably
and what he said was wrong, but those hecklers were also out of line. The thing escalated so quickly. Mm-hmm. And
I think he was... I agree. Yeah, I think he was trying to do what comedians do, and that is engage their hecklers and defeat them. And there's an art to that. So in any case, if you get a chance, what is it? Riding in cars with comedians getting coffee. It's something along those lines. I think those, I may have one of the elements backward, but it's a Seinfeld thing. And he has each episode, he's in a car getting coffee with some comedian. So the one that's got Michael Richards, it's actually very sad because it's like an apology tour where Michael Richards, they're talking about this incident. And I have to give credit to Jerry Seinfeld for having the courage. I don't know if courage is the right word, but having the, you know, the gumption to have Michael Richards on and let him tell his side of the story. So anyway, maybe if the Grammy Awards are any indication of it, maybe, just maybe, the cancel culture is on the wane. We'll see. I don't know. 888-914-9149 is the number. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. I'll be right back. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a new free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, Lunger, let's do it.
Thanks, Lunger. I love this stuff. You know that. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show, where the number is 888-914-9149. You know, I wanted to share this story with you a few weeks ago on the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of an attack against the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe. This was in the old Basilica in Mexico City. And just a quick primer here on what I'm referring to. So back in, gosh, now 1531, so going back nearly 500 years, just shy of 500 years, Our Lady appeared in what is now Mexico City to an Indian who is a convert, an indigenous man. His Christian name is Saint Juan Diego. He's been canonized. That's why I call him Saint. And he was on his way to visit an uncle nearby who was ill. And a young woman, resplendent, shining with light, very beautiful, clearly supernatural, she appeared to him. And she talked to him and asked him to go to the bishop down the mountain and in the city and tell him that she would like to have a church built on the spot where she was appearing to him. And as you might imagine, he was not sure what to make of this. And so he didn't immediately carry out her request. In fact, the following day, he was going back to visit his ailing uncle, and he decided to take a different route so that he would not see her again, because he figured she'll probably be there again when I go visit my uncle. So he took a different route around the other side of the hill, and she appeared to him there. So he said, yes, I'll do what you want me to do. He went down into the city, and he presented himself at the cathedral where the bishop resided, and asked to tell the bishop. They said, what do you want to tell him? And he said, well, a lady appeared to me. She wants to have a church built there. And so you can imagine the servants are like, yeah, whatever. So he was told to bring back some evidence of this. And they probably assumed that he would not be able to do that. They probably assumed, I'm guessing, he was like a crackpot. So he went back, and in a later conversation with this young woman, Our Lady, who appeared to him, she said, here's your sign. And she pointed to some roses that were in full bloom. And the thing that makes that miraculous is that this is, you know, up in the foothills of the mountains surrounding Mexico City. And it was in December. We celebrate the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe on December the 12th, today being the feast of the Immaculate Conception, December the 8th. And so it was cold and there was snow on the ground. And so to have roses of all things blooming in the middle of the snow at that high elevation was highly unusual, to say the least. So he gathered these roses into his tilma. Now, the tilma is an indigenous term. It refers to a cloak that he wore. It would be like a poncho, if you can imagine a roughly woven poncho woven out of the fibers of a local plant. I believe it was the agave plant, if I'm not mistaken. And so it was intended to be used for a few years before it would fall apart and you'd get a new one. and you'd carry firewood in it. So the front part of it could be lifted up and you could put firewood in it or other things. Children, for example, if you were a mother, and you would carry things around in this garment. So he gathered up the roses. He went back down. He went into the city again, went to the cathedral, and he was admitted into the presence of the bishop. And when he opened his tilma and the roses came out, that, of course, was startling. But more startling yet was the image of the woman that he had been speaking to that had been imprinted on the rough fibers of his tilma. Now, that he didn't know was going to happen. Nobody expected it. And so this image has been studied rigorously by scientists, even in the present day with our very sophisticated scientific instrumentation. And there's no explanation for how this image got onto these fibers. It wasn't drawn and then painted. It wasn't painted. It wasn't dyed. There's no indication of any application of these colors, these pigments to the fibers. They're just there in the fibers. They're there. The blues and the golds and things of that nature. Now, there were embellishments that were added later, but the original image itself is miraculous. And even more so because in more recent years, we have developed the ability to use microscopes and zoom in to see details that are invisible to the unaided human eye. And among the things that scientists have seen now are the reflections of the people in the room when St. Juan Diego opened the tilma and showed what he thought would be the roses, but it turned out to be this miraculous image that was imprinted somehow on the tilma. And the amazing thing about this is that now with our modern instrumentation, we can see something that we didn't even know existed as a phenomenon in terms of optics, and that is the images of the people standing in the room, including the bishop himself. I believe that it's a total of 13 people. One group seems to be a family. It appears to be a mother with a baby on her back in like a backpack, some children, some servants, the father, the dad is there, the bishop is there. And in the case of the bishop, you see him with his mouth open like, oh my gosh, he's just, whatever it is they're seeing, they're astonished by it. So that's another more recent discovery of the tilma. It's been around for 500 years. It hasn't fallen to pieces the way that kind of garment normally would. It is just as supple and as intact as it would have been. And the interesting thing about it is that even though now it's behind bulletproof glass, it's been behind bulletproof glass for many decades, and I'm about to tell you one reason why it's behind bulletproof glass now. But if you go to the new basilica, new as of maybe 40 years ago, the new basilica that was built in Mexico City, you can see the tilma, and there's a people mover, an escalator, but it doesn't go up. It's just sort of flat. And you can go by it and see it, but you can't stop. You can't touch it. You can see it close, but not to the point where you can touch it. And the reason for that is that in the earlier basilica, which is still there, they've reopened it. It was sinking under the Mexico City is built on an old lake, and so the ground is not terribly firm in some places. So that old basilica started to sink, so they closed it, and it was then that they built a new basilica. But almost 100 years ago, so it was November the 14th, 1921, there was an attack, and Catholic News Agency has an article on this, which will get posted for you so you can read about it yourself. But it's a fascinating and, I believe, miraculous example of how this attack against the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe was foiled. Now, keep in mind, 1921 was at the height, and the height continued for years after this, but it was certainly in the midst of the most ferocious persecution of the Catholic Church ever seen in Mexico. And this was perpetrated by the government, which was riddled with atheists, communists, Masons, who wanted to just destroy the Catholic Church. And so it was in the middle of this that somebody went into that church, went into the old basilica, and planted a bomb, dynamite, in fact, a bundle of dynamite sticks. And whoever did this planted the dynamite in the flowers beneath the image of the tilma that was hanging above an altar in the basilica. Now, one thing to remember is that for the for the ensuing years, so from 1531 until 1921, so we're talking here roughly 400 years, there was no special care taken of the tilma. It was not hermetically sealed. It wasn't shielded from sunlight. People handled it. Countless people, thousands of people touched it. And it was exposed to the soot from candles and incense. And it was carried around outdoors often, and it was exposed to direct sunlight. Now, this is an artifact that, for us at least nowadays, goes back 500 years. And if you've ever been into a major museum, you know that they take very, very meticulous care of these ancient artifacts so that they don't disintegrate because of exposure to things like that. It was exposed to torchlight, to flash photography in the 20th century. And it's still, as I say, just as supple and as bright and beautiful as it ever was. It didn't diminish in its beauty at all. So now, 100 years ago, there's this dynamite attack. The dynamite goes off. It shatters the windows in the basilica, destroys all of the pews anywhere near this. It destroys the steps up to the altar that are made of marble. Brass candlesticks, an image of the crucified Jesus on very heavy, very, very large and heavy, I believe it's iron. I've seen it before. It's a large crucifix, and so many things around this were destroyed. The crucifix of our Lord is bent over. It kind of looks as though maybe the crucifix at the moment of the blast, at least this is one view of this, is that it bent down and shielded the image from the explosion. But the point is, all these other things around it were destroyed. The image was untouched, completely untouched. Even the glass in front of it, certainly not bulletproof glass, it didn't affect it at all. It was completely untouched. So here's what the Catholic News Agency says. It was around 10:30 in the morning when the bomb went off. It was hidden among flowers. I mentioned to you the damage that was done, the crucifix that was twisted. The explosion bent the crucifix, which is now known as Santo Cristo del Atentado, or the Holy Christ of the attack. Testimony of this is the Christ who is bent, and that we have here in the Basilica of Guadalupe itself as a testimony of the immense love of God, of the marvelous love of God for Our Lady and for all of us who still have her here. This is one of the people quoted in the article. The story recalls that the glass of the painting that protected the image did not break, did not crack. Nothing happened to it. And this bomb was a matter of just a couple of feet below this image. The attack was the prelude to what would become an even worse persecution in Mexico under the government of Plutarco Elias Calles. He was the one who ordered the execution of Father Miguel Pro. You may remember that in 1927. Not that you remember it, but you may remember the story. And it was 100 years ago, a couple of weeks ago, that this happened. And I have to imagine that if the government ordered this done, or if whoever planned this attack was reading the newspapers the following day and maybe went back to the scene of the crime to see what had happened, probably pretty disappointed that all these sticks of dynamite had no effect whatsoever on the tilma. Now, is that in itself a miracle? I kind of think so. I mean, it strikes me as hard to explain outside of some miraculous intervention. I don't know how else to explain it myself. But that is still there. And when you go to Mexico City, if you should go there and you go to the Basilica, you can not only see the tilma, still inexplicable. Modern science has not been able to figure out how this happened. Modern science has not been able to figure out how it is that 500 years ago, in this very primitive society, and by primitive, I'm including also the Europeans, because they didn't have access to the scientific means that we have today, far from it. They still can't figure out how these images of the people in the room who saw what happened are there. It's just miraculous and remains so to this day. And you can add to the fact that when you go to Mexico City, you will also see this twisted heavy iron crucifix that absorbed the blast. It certainly looks like it's charred and twisted, and the image of Our Lady is completely untouched. To me, that's a miracle. And if science can explain it, fair enough. But until then, I regard that as a miracle. And I also regard the clock telling me that I have to take a break. So we'll do that now. We'll come right back to more of your comments and questions. You can call me. We have a couple lines open, 888-914-9149. In a little bit, I'm also going to share with you the history of St. Cecilia and the Roman catacombs. Fascinating story there. Maybe you've seen this. I'll tell you some more about that on the other side of this quick timeout. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
We are back. Thank you for listening. The number again, 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We'll go first. Let's see where we're going to go. Let's go to James in Covina, California. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question. Here's my question. I have a computer that sits on top of a stand. And if you could just picture it, this stand at the end has like ridges so that the computer doesn't slide off, right?
Okay.
So there's a bed that's about 2 inches from that computer. And last night I was in a Zoom meeting, and you know, every day, this computer's in the same place every day. So this morning I get up, you know, I do my prayer time, I do my rosary, I have a crucifix in the room, and, you know, I have everything in the room. So I go to the bathroom, and I'm shaving, stuff like that, and I hear this sound, this bang. So I open the room, the door, and the computer is right next to the bed on the floor. So I tell myself, how did that get from there to there? And then I experiment. I got the computer and I put it on top of the ridges to see if it would fall. And it doesn't even fall. It slides and it kind of like the friction just holds it. So my question is this. Number one, is that a manifestation of a demon? Because I don't deal in any of this occult. It's like I do everything I'm supposed to do. So I'm wondering, why did that happen? Or am I imagining? I mean, is that something that just maybe it just fell off? But how could it fall off? It's impossible.
Well, my first reaction is to look for a natural explanation. And I grant you, sometimes it looks as though there's no natural explanation for this. And then sometimes I found it like, oh, yeah, okay, it was that. So there may be some natural explanation for it, but let's say that you've exhausted every possibility and you can't find a natural explanation for it. To answer your question, it is possible that there is some diabolical interference. It does happen. The devil likes to mess with us when he's permitted to do so. But I wouldn't make that my first assumption. I would first try to find a natural explanation for it. And only if there's no natural explanation for it would I begin to think that it might be otherworldly. But it's possible. So in that case, maybe the thing to do is consider, is there anything in your home? Did somebody come and visit you, a relative, a friend or something, even if it was a while ago, and maybe might have brought something into the home? I've heard of situations like that before where people find out that somebody brought a Ouija board with them or somebody brought some other, you know, occult item and left it behind. So that may not be a very common thing, but I've heard of it before. And then you could also ask your parish priest to come to your home and bless your house, bless that room with holy water, pray some prayers of deliverance. And I would think you probably wouldn't see things like this again in the future. But it is possible.
Okay. Because I tell myself I don't like to go there. I do look for that. I don't say, you know, I'm not into this, you know, oh, it's a demon and every under every rock. And I experiment. I got the computer, I put it on top of here. I said, okay, if it fell, it wouldn't have fallen on the floor, it would just have just fallen on the desk, and it was secured. As far as somebody coming over, I did have a person stay over this past week. he's a pilot and is a friend of my daughter and her husband, and he just said about 2 days. But I mean, he didn't have anything with him. He didn't have anything behind. My wife cleaned the whole house yesterday, and she didn't find anything at all. You know, so I agree with you. I don't go there. I don't try to imagine things. I say that's some explanation natural, but I don't know what to explain it here. And I tell myself another question is that if it is that kind of manifestation, I mean, why would God let that happen? I mean, I'm not involved in that stuff. I mean, I do my rosary, I pray, I have holy water, and if it happened, I get kind of confused. And why is that happening?
Well, I can't say with certitude, you know, only God would know the answer to that question, but I can offer a few thoughts. One would be that if your guest brought with him something either as an item into the house, that's possible, or may, and I have no desire whatsoever to cast aspersions on anybody. So this may be completely unrelated to your guests, but I am aware of situations in which people will be guests in homes and they will do something evil or they will bring something evil in with them. And then there's a lingering presence after they're gone. So it could even be something like, let's say he, and again, I hesitate to say this because he may be a perfectly fine human being. There may be nothing wrong. But one possibility is if a guest in your home was looking at pornography, for example, that opens a portal into your home. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will always happen, but that's the kind of thing where on a case-by-case basis, it could happen. So that's a possibility. It could be that there is something going on in that person's life, in his life, and when he was there, so was that issue, so was that problem. So these are just possibilities. I don't know. But you're asking, why would God allow this to happen? Well, God will not allow anything to happen to you that he does not will for your ultimate good. So if God were to permit the evil one to harass you or to try to disturb you in some way, and he did this repeatedly to the great saints, he permitted the great saints to experience lots of diabolical harassment, you know, even physical beatings and things. St. John Vianney, St. John Bosco, St. Teresa of Avila, St. Padre Pio. I mean, the list is a very long one of those saints that God permitted the evil one to torment and to harass. But they always triumphed. And I believe in writing, or rather reading the writings about their lives, I believe that one of the key reasons is to manifest his power over the evil one and to manifest his power in his saints. So let's assume, well, let's not assume, but let's say that if this was something like that, it's nothing to be fearful of as long as you're close to Christ and receiving the sacraments, you're doing the right thing. You have nothing to fear from it. But if that's what it is, then it would be by God's permission. And it would be maybe for your intensification in your own holiness, your own commitment. It could be also, let me just look at the time. Yeah, I've got time. It could also be not diabolical, but it could also be a perhaps clumsy way for a soul in purgatory trying to get your attention and maybe ask for prayer. I told the story some weeks ago about when I was speaking at a parish in the Archdiocese of Oklahoma. And I don't know if you heard this story, James, but very briefly, I was staying for that day in the room, one of the rooms in the rectory of this parish. It was a large rectory, probably enough for four priests, each with their own bedroom and living room, bathroom, etc. So I was taking a shower, and while I was soaping up the shampoo, I could hear a man standing literally no more than 2 feet away from me in the bathroom right outside the shower curtain, and he was speaking. And I practically jumped out of my skin. Who on earth is inside this room, this bathroom, with me? And I wiped the soap from my eyes, and I poked my head out from behind the shower curtain, and there's nobody there. But I'm telling you, the sound of this person standing, it was a man standing there speaking, was unmistakable. It absolutely happened. I wasn't dreaming it. I wasn't asleep. It absolutely happened. I was as awake then as I'm awake right now talking to you. So later that day, I asked the parish priest about this, and I said, I heard somebody in my room standing there talking to me. And he got a look on his face, And he said, well, there was a priest who used to be here at this parish, and he died in that room a year or two ago, 3 years ago, whatever it was. And so I didn't feel menaced by this, but I was startled by it, but I didn't feel menaced by it. And I took that to mean that maybe this priest was being permitted by God to become present in some way to ask me to pray for him. So I started praying for him. And when I get to heaven, I'll find out if that's what it really was, but that's what I thought it was. So it's possible that it could be something like that as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be diabolical.
I see. Okay, well, thank you, Patrick. So I don't have to fear that thing, but if I don't do anything about it, like call a priest, you think he could manifest again, or I should just call a priest if I can't find any natural explanation?
What I would do first is I would go in there, if I were you, with holy water, and I would bless the room, and I would invoke the protection of Almighty God. I would ask him to send his angels to guard your home, and I would pray prayers of deliverance, asking St. Michael the Archangel, etc., to intercede and defend your home, and then see what happens. And maybe nothing else will happen, and everything will be fine. If something continues, then yes, I would invite the priest to come in and bless the home, because he's got more firepower in that regard than you or I do as lay people. But see what happens, and there may be nothing more to it. That may be all there is. But these things do happen. I just don't want you to think that just because something weird took place that it's necessarily preternatural. You know what I mean?
Okay, and not necessarily that I'm doing something wrong either. I mean, I'm not sinning. I'm not living in sin, so I tell myself. But it just happens, like you say, to the saints. So I guess it just happens. Okay, Patrick. All right, well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You got it. Thank you. Let's go now to Gabriella, who's listening in Houston, California. Good morning, Gabriella. It's been a while since we've talked.
Yes, it has. So my question is why on the Advent wreath the colors are always purple, purple, pink, purple? Like, why aren't they any other color? Why just purple, purple, pink, purple?
Ah, okay. Well, the reason for the color is that purple is the liturgical color for the season of Advent. And Advent is where we're awaiting the Lord's birth. We're longing for him. And so purple as a color has been used in the church to symbolize that kind of waiting and preparation. We see the same color used during Lent in preparation for the Lord's resurrection. Yeah. So that's where the purple comes from. Now, the rose-colored candle, we say pink, but I think more precisely it would be rose. It'd be like the rose-colored vestments that priests sometimes wear. That is symbolic of our joy and the joy of knowing that Jesus is soon to be born. And then, of course, there is the wreath itself. And the wreath is made of evergreen. Pardon me?
Never mind. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. The wreath itself is made out of evergreens, and that is symbolic of our eternal hope in Jesus. You know, just as an evergreen doesn't lose its color in the wintertime, it's evergreen, and that's symbolic of our hope in the Lord as well.
Oh, thank you very much.
Because, you're welcome.
I was reading a story of a German Christmas, and it's a story, their candles are all red. They're not like that.
Yeah. Well, that's different from the traditional colors, but I'll have to investigate why those are red. Anyway, thank you, Gabriella. Nice to talk to you. I'll be back with hour two of the program right after this quick timeout. Please stay right there.